emirs. By 10:30, the Samanids were finished. They actually escaped off to a lonely exile in an island in the Caspian Sea, which is an exile place for a lot of ex-rulers, as we'll see in the Mongol period. And the result was the Eastern Islam was partitioned between the Ghaznavid sultans and the Karakhanids. And the Oxus was accepted again as the boundary. That is the Amusara, a classic boundary. Balkh fell into the hands of Mahmud. The Karakhanids were content with the cities of Transoxiana. And it looked like Mahmud and then his successors would go on to unite Eastern Islam. The next step was Baghdad to get a firman from the caliph directly. It didn't happen. And that is because a third group suddenly intervened and knocked out both contenders. And those were the Seljuk Turks. The Seljuk Turks, their ancestors were known as Oğuz Turks or Güz Turks, as they'd be called in Arabic. And the Oğuz Turks had settled in the Jaxartes Valley, the lands around the Aral Sea. They're responsible for kicking out the Pechenegs in the 9th century. They enter into the Islamic world in the 10th century, and the founder of this tribe, known as Seljuk, who gave his name to the whole tribe, moved into the region known as Khorasan. That is eastern Iran today. It's also part of Afghanistan and Turkmenistan. It's an important border area with the great cities of Nishapur. It has close connections with the city of Merv. And so in Khorasan, the Turks arrived as settlers. They were military colonists. There is also a thesis that's been advanced that they were very big on the Silk Road because they provided the camels. I mentioned in an earlier lecture that there was a crossbreeding of the dromedary from Arabia with the two-humped Bactrian camel to create a camel in Central Asia that was still able to handle the cold winters, but had the advantages of the Arabian breed with greater staying power, better conservation of water. And the Seljuk Turks seem to have been involved in that breeding. They were supplying the caravans with the camels. And there is a major expansion of the caravan trade in the 10th century, particularly in cottons and linens. That is, the Samanid emirs and really were very, very assiduous in promoting different plantation systems across northern Iran to supply the growing markets of both Baghdad, but also the cities of northern Iran, Transoxiana, and even India. So the Seljuk Turks arrived as colonists. They were settled in part because of their military abilities. They were in essentially a frontier zone. Furthermore, they were involved in the caravan trade, and there was always a need for nomads in Khorasan and Transoxiana because there's a close association with people tending flocks and herds with supplying the agriculturalists in the cities. Well, the grandsons of Seljuk, and the oldest one, the most important one, Turil Bey, and his brother, Chahra Bey, they took power over these tribes, and they exploited the clash between the Karakhanids and the Ghaznavid sultans. And they were settled in the area of Bukhara around 1025 by the Karakhanids. They went over to Mahmud when he occupied the city, and then they went into business for themselves. And in the 1030s, they swept through many of the cities of eastern Iran, and Turil Bey was very, very careful. He imposed discipline on his soldiers. They were not only excellent nomadic warriors, but they represented themselves as agents of the caliph in Baghdad. They were Sunni Muslims. In 1037, he had himself proclaimed a sultan in Nishapur. That is a very important title that gains currency in the 11th century. It means guardian. That is, you're the guardian of the interests of the Abbasid caliphs. The then reigning Ghaznavid ruler, Masud, was using the same title. And on May 23rd, 1040, in the vicinity of Merv, Turil Bey won a major victory over the Ghaznavid army. It was a classic victory of Turkish cavalry over an army that had come to depend very, very heavily on Indian forces. Masud had brought up infantry and even war elephants from India. He did not have access to the same number of cavalrymen, and the battle proved decisive. In 1040, the Ghaznavids essentially were forced to retreat into India. The Karakhanids were pushed back to the Jaxartes. All of Transoxiana fell into the hands of Turul Bey. And the Turkish armies began to march relentlessly across northern Iran, being received at all the great caravan cities, Hamadan, Rav, Tabriz. And again, they arrived not as nomadic barbarians, not as conquerors, but as Sunni Muslims, as agents of the caliph. And in 1055, Turul Bey entered Baghdad itself. And at that point, he had reached the pinnacle of his power, because his position as sultan was now confirmed by the caliph. He henceforth ruled as the guardian, the sultan of the caliph, Qayyim. He married a daughter of the caliph who entered the harem. And henceforth, the Abbasid caliphate is going to be directed by a Turkish sultan. The victory of Turul Bey was spectacular, unexpected. But in capturing Baghdad, the Seljuk Sultan Turul Bey and his successors found that they now had a problem of meeting foes on all sorts of frontiers. There were still the Karakhanids to the northeast. The Ghaznavids were always in India, could mount a comeback. But above all, they now assumed the commitment of dealing with the Shia caliphs of Cairo and their Christian allies, the Byzantine emperors of Constantinople.
Lecture 23, Turks in Anatolia and India.
In this lecture, I wish to deal with the implications of the rise of the Seljuk Turks. The Seljuk Turks are responsible for conquering really two new regions to the Islamic world. As I mentioned in the previous lectures, particularly with regard to the Abbasid Caliphate, that for nearly 300 years, the political and military expansion of the Islamic world had halted. And during that same period, Abbasid caliphs and various emirs ruling in the name of the Abbasid caliph came to depend on Turkish military power. Well, once the Seljuk Turks emerged as a major factor in Eastern Islam, they are responsible for conquering two new regions that were not previously part of Dar al-Islam. That is Anatolia, often referred to as Asia Minor. The modern Turkish name is Anadolu, but it really is a Greek word. That would be today the Asiatic portions of the Republic of Turkey. The second area that the Seljuk Turks are responsible for, kind of indirectly, is northern India. Particularly the region around Delhi, the so-called region, the Doab, that strategic zone, that very fertile zone that essentially links the upper tributaries of the Indus, the Punjab, the land of the five rivers, with the upper Ganges, and forms the center of any imperial power on the Indo-Gangic plain in the subcontinent. Both of these areas, northern India and Anatolia, are directly or indirectly brought into the Islamic world by the power of Seljuk Turks, or people who had been pushed into India fighting the same way, notably the Ghaznavids, who were also depending on Turkish power. So this lecture is a lecture of comparative conquests. Let us first turn to the West and to the Seljuk Turks directly. I mentioned last time that in 1055, Turul Bey, the leader of the Seljuk Turks, self-styled sultan, had entered the city of Baghdad. That represented the pinnacle of his military achievement over the last, since 1037, when he had essentially proclaimed himself sultan. And henceforth, Turul Bey and his successors, his nephew Al-Arslan, and eventually the third Seljuk sultan, Malik Shah, they were confronted with running a vast empire far greater than any Turkish ruler had yet administered. They had perfected the technique of using Persian administrators. They, of course, obtained the bureaucratic structures of Baghdad. They had now the wealth of a good chunk of the Silk Road to tap into. But on the other hand, they now faced a series of commitments that really strained Seljuk resources from the very start. I mentioned that there were still the Kari Khanates to the east who might contest Transoxiana. There were also the Ghaznavids and their various subordinate vassal allies who could come back out of India and the borderlands of Afghanistan. But above all, it was the Western Front that was important. In Cairo, since 973, resided the Fatimid Caliphs. As I had mentioned, they represented a counter-caliph to the Sunni caliph in Baghdad. Tughril Bey and his Seljuk Turks professed Sunni Islam. They fought in the name of the sultan, of the caliph, and therefore they were now stuck with the problem of dealing with Cairo, and that was now the priority. Not the access to the Eurasian steppes, not even so much the Silk Road, but knocking out the sectarian rival who really posed a challenge of authority to the Abbasid caliphate as well as to the sultan. Furthermore, in 1055, it became clear very quickly that Tughril Bey had to have a reckoning with the government in Cairo. The Seljuk Turks, once they had occupied Baghdad, withdrew. There were reasons for this. Large numbers of nomadic warriors, Ghazi warriors, as the term is, as they're usually called, annoy the urban population. They may have been Sunni Muslims, but in day-to-day transactions with the urban population of Baghdad, there were the usual clashes between rude nomadic warriors. The best thing was to get these guys out of Baghdad, send them up to Azerbaijan, or try to settle them on the Al Jazeera, the grasslands between the Euphrates and Tigris River. These areas were at least conducive to the Turks. They had grasslands. The Seljuk Turks had brought their families. They could find pasture and water for their horses, and they would be out of the hair of the urban population of Baghdad. When the Seljuk army had essentially withdrawn, there was a revolt in Baghdad. A number of the chief ministers around the caliph subverted the Turkish bodyguard. Those were the slave troops, the Harash. They had been the effective power for a long time, really since the early 9th century. And they staged a revolt and called in a Fatimid army, which occupied Baghdad for 40 days. And during those 40 days, at the Friday prayer at midday, the name of the Fatimid caliph was announced in Baghdad as a mark of loyalty, not the Abbasid caliph. Well, this was intolerable. Tughril Bey appeared immediately, chased out the Fatimid army. Everyone involved in the conspiracy was arrested. That Turkish bodyguard was finally disbanded. And the result was Tughril Bey is henceforth committed to a war against Cairo. All the Turkish resources had to be put on Cairo. The eastern and northeastern fronts could wait for later. Well, I had mentioned in passing in the previous lecture that the Fatimid caliphs of Cairo had come to an agreement with the Orthodox emperors of Constantinople. And the Byzantine emperors at this time, in 1055, were representatives of the old Macedonian dynasty. Actually, the Macedonian dynasty died out in 1055, 1056, and the Byzantine state was deeply divided between two factions, a civil elite in the capital that wanted to slash military expenditures, and a military elite based largely in Anatolia with the states, who, of course, put priority on the frontiers. And very, very quickly, it was the civilian group that came to dominate politics in Constantinople. And that had dire consequences for the military budget and the efficiency of the Byzantine army. In 1059, the civilian elite put their guy on the throne, a man named Constantine Doukas, Constantine X. Well, the Byzantine emperors also had an accommodation with the Fatimid caliphate. The government in Cairo and the government in Constantinople had, up until the arrival of the Seljuk Turks, an understanding that the pilgrimage routes across the Byzantine Empire into the Fatimid Empire would be protected, that Christians had rights to the access of Jerusalem. There was a famous treaty signed in 1001 that guaranteed this. And so the Byzantines who controlled northern Syria, the Fatimids who controlled southern Syria and the rest of the Levant, they provided the opportunity for Christian pilgrims from Western Europe to come in increasing numbers to Jerusalem. Well, this had two important consequences for Tughril Bey and his Seljuk Turks. First, He turned his Turkish regiments on the Byzantine Empire to keep the Byzantine emperors distracted. At the same time, he concentrated the bulk of his forces to take first Syria and Jerusalem, then the holy cities Mecca and Medina, and finally Cairo. This fighting disrupted the pilgrimage routes. As a direct consequence, Pope Urban II is going to preach the First Crusade in 1095. It also had another important consequence, and that is not the Sultan's armies initially, but his subordinates, his emirs, began to attack Asia Minor and found no resistance. And in Anatolia, in Byzantine Anatolia, they found cities to sack, but also grasslands very similar to their homeland in Central Asia, areas that they could exploit, they knew how to exploit. Furthermore, this region was not occupied by Muslims, it was occupied by Christians. You could fight as a Ghazi warrior in the name of jihad, holy war. This was an ideal place for Turkish expansion. And starting in 1055, Turkish tribal armies start to raid across Anatolia. The Byzantine state reacts very ineptly, especially under Constantine X. The army's not up to the job. There is a political struggle in Constantinople. In 1067, the Emperor Constantine X dies. His widow Eudoxia briefly rules on her own. And the military elite force the empress to marry a general, a man called Romanus IV, Diogenes. And Romanus gets his job as emperor to reckon with the Seljuk Turks. Now, unfortunately for Romanus, he inherited a treasury that had been bankrupt by 50 years of incompetence, particularly by the empresses Zoe and Theodora, the high-maintenance empresses of the 11th century. He also inherited an army that was in a very, very poor state. It comprised largely of mercenaries. It did not have a sense of victory. It was not a uniform force. Romanus tried to bring the raiders to bear, but it was difficult because the Turks instinctively had learned the various routes across Asia Minor. They knew where to enter the passes, where to cross the Taurus. They had essentially blitzed Armenia, seized the cities of Ani and Kars, which they're using as bases. And the fighting climaxes in the year 1071 when Romanus IV marches a large field army east and encounters the new sultan, Alp Arslan, the nephew of Tuğrul Bey, who had come to the throne in 1063. And in August of 1071, the two armies encounter each other at the distant town of Manzikert, which is today in eastern Turkey. It is on grasslands that are ideal to the Turkish cavalry, and Romanus is lured into a battle. He is usually criticized for ineptitude, particularly by some of the contemporary sources, notably Michael Psellus, but if you believe Psellus, you'll believe anything. Actually, Romanus did a very credible job. He drew up his army immediately to the west of the modern town, which still has heavy fortifications built from the Byzantine age. There's still an Ottoman fortress built on top of it, and he put his infantry in the center. He had the usual flanking forces with archers. His cavalry was in reserve, and he fought a classic battle, the sort of battle that would have been recommended by Byzantine authors as well as by Tang generals. The problem was he was betrayed, and he also commanded an army that was really had no sense of unity. They had been put together for this expedition. And he held his own over the course of the day. And then as the as they marched and countermarched, at the end of the day, Romanus called his army together, called a halt, and informed his army that they would fall back to the camp because they could not bring the Turks to battle. His army was perhaps 35,000. The Turks may have been around 20,000. The infantry wheel around, and given their inexperience, they open up gaps, which Alp Arslan exploits. The army is thrown in confusion. The rumor goes out that the emperor is killed. It's not true. Actually, the emperor falls into the hands of the sultan. And the cavalry forces, particularly the forces in the rear that were supposed to prevent this, defected. Notably, the forces of Andronicus Doukas, who was related to the empress. It was actually I believe she's the Empress's nephew. And he galloped off along with most of the other cavalry because they were going to seize power in Constantinople. And when Romanus was finally released, he got the general Byzantine retirement package. That is, he was blinded and dumped in a monastery, and a new emperor is put on the throne, Michael VII, a totally unfit ruler. The victory at Manzikert was stunning. It's usually dated to the 19th of August, 1071. It is still celebrated as a great event in Turkey today. You can go there and see these remarkable monuments, these twin pillars. They look like something out of 2001, A Space Odyssey. Nonetheless, the battle opened up Asia Minor to settlement by the Seljuk Turks. As I said, the main effort was fighting the Fatimid Caliphs, and therefore independent bands of Turks moved into Asia Minor and carved out their own principalities. Foremost was Konya, the ancient city of Iconium. Danishmed emirs seized the region around Niksar and Amasya in northeastern Turkey. And within a decade, most of Asia Minor had fallen into the hands of Turkish adventurers, technically professing to be the emirs or the sultans, the subordinates of the Turkish sultan in Baghdad, and after 1072, that was Malik Shah, but really they were independent operators. And this added to the confusion and disruption of the peninsula. Well, the Byzantine emperors had no choice but to take Asia Minor back. They had stupidly allowed the peninsula to fall into the hands of the Seljuk Turks, and in 1081, a very successful general battles his way to the throne. His name is Alexis I Comnenus, and he decides to call in Western Europeans as mercenaries to beat back the Turks and retake Asia Minor. And that appeal is interpreted by Pope Urban II as a call to arms to liberate Jerusalem. And presto, Alexis I does not get 2,000 mercenaries, but the First Crusade, as over 50,000 Western Europeans between 1097 and 1099 stream across Asia Minor, making a beeline to Jerusalem. This battle, it's really a three-sided struggle, Byzantines, Crusaders, and Seljuk Turks, results in a seesaw struggle across Asia Minor over the course of the 12th century. And initially, the Crusaders win stunning victories over the Seljuk Turks. In part, the novelty of Western European cavalry takes the Turks by surprise. Kilij Arslan of the Sultan of Konya is decisively defeated at the Battle of Dorylaeum. Western Asia Minor and the coastal regions of Asia Minor fall back under Byzantine control. However, the Byzantine emperors can never drive the Turks off the plateau, because the Turkish tribes settle in significant numbers, come to terms with the Christian agriculturists, and begin to create a Turkish heartland in this peninsula. And as I've said many times, the peninsula of Asia Minor is essentially a fragment of Central Asia that has been thrust into a Mediterranean peninsula, and the Turks are able to bring in their herds, their people, their families, and establish a Turkish society on the plateau. The Christian agriculturalists there living in the river valleys come to terms with them, very well documented by all the rock-cut churches that date from this period, where the Christians, who are no longer under Byzantine rule, pay a tribute to the Seljuk Turks. And eventually at Konya, a Seljuk-Turkish civilization will emerge. The fighting also plays into the hands of the Seljuk Turk. It's a desultory war over the borders, which sees the breakdown of Byzantine institutions and cities, the road system. All of this results that the conditions in Asia Minor favor the Turkish way of war, the nomadic way of war. Large parts of Asia Minor pass out of agricultural use into grasslands, and steadily the balance shifts in favor of the Turks. Two events confirm this. In 1176, the Emperor Manuel I is decisively beaten at the Battle of Myriokephalon in 1176. That marks the end of Byzantine efforts to expel the Seljuk Turks out of Asia Minor. On the 13th through the 15th of April, 1204, members of the Fourth Crusade storm into the city of Constantinople and sack it. Byzantine power is finished. The political and ultimately the cultural destinies of Asia Minor have now shifted decisively to the Seljuk Turks settled in Anatolia, who will now turn that region into a new Muslim Turkish-speaking land. That will be the subject of an upcoming lecture. Now, while the Seljuk Turks are winning these victories in the West, there are significant battles going on the eastern frontier. And I want to turn for a moment to look at some of the parallel conquests going on, conducted by various Turkish generals into India. When we look at northern India at the time, it is important to get a couple of points straight. India at this point is divided among a number of competing kingdoms. In the modern nationalist literature of India today, these kings are often severely criticized for not joining together and meeting the Turkish threat. Primarily, it's Turkish cavalry. There will be Arabs and Persians as well, but what is invading India are Turkish cavalry, both tribal regiments as well as slave soldiers. Well, that's an unfair criticism because at this point there really was no united India. The last man to rule over a united India was the king Harshah Vardhan, who ruled from approximately 606, I believe, to 647. He was in the 7th century. His capital was at Kannauj, very close to where Delhi is today. He controlled the sacred cities of India, notably Varanasi. And that state, which was a successor state to the Gupta Empire, that state had collapsed in the mid-7th century. And since then, you had a competing set of kingdoms trying to gain control of what in the Hindu text is known as Airavata. That is the Aryan homeland. And when I use the term Aryan, I'm using it in the Indian context. It means people who speak a language based off Sanskrit, or if they speak Dravidian languages, they accept the Sanskrit text, the Rig Vedas, the Upanishads, the Mahabharata, the stories of Rama. They are devoted to the reorganized Hindu cults as they had emerged in the first century BC, notably to Shiva and to Vishnu. The Brahmins are the religious elite who administer the rites. And so Aryan means, or Aryan civilization, the adoption of that whole higher Hindu culture and cults associated with the Sanskrit text and the primacy of caste, Varna, with the Brahmins taking center stage, particularly in southern and central India, the Kshatriya caste, that is the warrior royal caste, now occupying a second position. And that is what we refer to when we talk of Airavata. Now, that region essentially encompasses the Indus Valley, the Doab, the regions around Delhi today, and also the Ganges, the Ganja, the great river of the mother goddess that springs from the Himalayas, particularly from Mount Kailash, the home of the god Shiva. The effort of the Hindu kings was to control this region. And when a Hindu king in particular gained ascendancy over his opponents, he didn't build great bureaucratic structures. He did not try to rule all of India the way, say, the Mauryan emperors had tried in the 3rd century BC or even the Gupta emperors. Instead, he accepted the submission of other kings, of other Rajas. And he would often conduct a royal progress, which is known as a